You're listening to the Incarcerated Christian Podcast, where we shine light on the dark side of Christianity and how it affects people and communities. I'm Robin Mitchell Stroud, and I'm here with my co-host, Deborah Levy Martinelli. We'll be covering a variety of topics, from individual survivor stories, including our own, to the influence of religion on our national politics. To learn more about the podcast, visit our website, theincarceratedchristian.com, or connect with us on TikTok and Instagram at The Incarcerated Christian, and on Twitter at @TICC_podcast_. Now, on to the show.
For many of us, October conjures up images of ghosts, goblins, jack-o'-lanterns, and haunted houses. This pop culture phenomenon seemed like a perfect backdrop for our podcast theme for this month, Holy Horrors. For both of our October episodes, we talk with Dr. Steve Wiggins, a theologian, scholar, and author who has written extensively about the abundance and significance of biblical and religious symbols in horror movies. Listen in as we explore with Dr. Wiggins how the Bible is translated through popular culture, notably horror movies, and how religious symbols, themes, and references are manifested in such classics as The Exorcist, The Omen, Rosemary's Baby, Psycho, Carrie, The Amityville Horror, and Children of the Corn. We hope you enjoy listening to Dr. Wiggins as much as we did talking with him. Our guest today is Dr. Steve Wiggins. He describes himself as an erstwhile academic, compulsive reader, indefatigable writer, sometimes editor, failed priest, non-judgmental vegan, and late monster boomer. That's so much more than anything I could have said about you. He holds a Bachelor of Arts degree in religion, a Master of Theological Studies degree in Biblical Studies and Church History, and a doctorate in the history of religions. And he has taught at Neshota House Episcopal Seminary, the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh, Rutgers University, and Montclair State University. Dr. Wiggins's areas of expertise include history of religions, comparative religions of the ancient Near East, including early Christianity, archaeology, Semitic goddesses, my personal favorite, Hebrew Bible, the Psalms, Genesis, and religion and science. He's written books for both academic audiences and, more recently, general audiences. Today, we're going to talk about the latter, particularly Holy Horror, The Bible and Fear in Movies, which was published in 2018. His latest book, which we hope to touch on as well, is Nightmares with the Bible, The Good Book and Cinematic Demons, which came out in 2020. Currently, he is an editor with a university press in New York. And he writes a daily blog, Sex, that's S-E-C-T-S, and Violence in the Ancient World. And he has a YouTube channel. You can find all of this and more at steveawiggins.com, which is linked in the show notes. Dr. Wiggins, welcome. We're very happy to have you here today.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the kind introduction.
Oh, yeah. And you know what I realized, Dr. Wiggins? We had a few technical problems right before this. So it just occurred to me, we didn't tell you which one of us is which one of us. I'm Robin. And that's Deborah, who just did your wonderful introduction. And welcome to the podcast. We are really happy to have you here.
Thank you. And please call me Steve, okay?
Okay.
Dr. Wiggins sounds too formal.
Okay, that's great. Yeah, thank you, Steve. So we came across your work while we were looking for critics of hell houses. And so I don't know exactly the connection that led us to you, but I got to your website and then went down so many rabbit holes. It was phenomenal. It was fantastic. You had written somewhere on your website that you cut your teeth, your reading teeth on the Bible, which I would say that I did that as well, since most of the books in our house growing up were Bibles. And then you had written in this particular book, Holy Horror, The Bible and Fear in Movies, that we have a culture that is high in biblical awareness and low in biblical literacy, which you had me at hello with that statement, and that horror movies can teach us about the Bible and that people understand the Bible through pop culture, including horror movies. So you're less interested in like the specific content of the Bible, although that's related. It's more about how it serves to sort of inform society. And then I would say too, I read somewhere in one of your works that scripture inspires fear through threatening, containing, or controlling, and that horror makes use of scripture. So scripture is good for controlling adherence, and it's good for entertainment. But before we get to that, and I'm going to be a little bit all over the place because there's so much stuff I would love to ask you about, and we only have less than an hour. But before we get to that, there are some what I would consider technical questions that I would love to ask you about after reading the book. So the first one is, there are three of them. The first one is, you use different names to describe the Bible in this book. You use the Good Book, Holy Writ, Scripture, and the Bible. And do you use those interchangeably, or do you use them differently for different reasons?
Actually, I use them all interchangeably, and it's basically a writer's trick to not repeat myself constantly. It drives me crazy when I'm reading a book written for general readers and the same phrase or word comes up over and over and over and over again. So it's an attempt to be more writerly. So that's all that was.
Okay. No, it's a fun read. And I like Holy Writ. I don't usually use Holy Writ. Okay. The second question is, you talk about the Bible, America's iconic Bible, as being Protestant and evangelical. And I agree with you on that. Would you also include I call them fundies because I was one, fundamentalists. Would you say that it's also fundamentalist, or would you say that it's really more Protestant and evangelical?
Well, I think fundamentalists tend to be a subgroup of Protestantism. And yes, I would include that. It's definitely part of the overall picture. I also grew up as a fundy. So that's my frame of reference. And when I see the Bible in culture, it's very seldom the Catholic Bible or any other Jewish Bible. It's the Protestant Bible. And so I would just include fundamentalists among Protestants.
Okay. And my third question is, and I asked this question because I was asked this question in my doctoral defense. So the verses that I cited in my dissertation are all King James verses. And in your book, you specifically point out in at least three sections, maybe four, that a particular verse that's used in a particular movie is the King James version of that verse. Now, why is that important to distinguish?
I think because when we think about America's iconic Bible, whatever that might be, it still tends to be the King James. And it's funny that we think of it that way, because among evangelicals, the most popular translation these days is the New International Version. It's by far, I think, more accessible than the King James. But there's that air or aura of holiness associated with Elizabethan English. And I think we just keep coming back to it. So whenever I quote the Bible, which I don't do very often, but when I do in my writings, I use the King James. I think it's just a culturally resonant thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I did because it's viewed as the only legitimate version of the Bible. The King James is the one true version. Okay, well, thank you for that. Those were just curiosity questions. And I know that Deborah's got more of sort of a broader question to start you off with.
Which is my greatest curiosity question. And that is, and maybe they go together. Number one, are you a movie buff? And number two, how did you marry movies and your background in religion and theology?
Those are very good questions. Yes, to the question about being a movie buff. I don't watch movies as much as some other people I know, but whenever I get the opportunity, yes, I will do it. Nobody in my family likes horror except for me, so it tends to be when I'm by myself or when I can find a few minutes. And I'll be sitting there scaring myself while everybody else is doing normal things. So, yeah, I'm really, and I grew up watching movies, mostly when they came to television, because we're not really an affluent family where I grew up. So it was watching television movies. But when I left home, I discovered that I could go to the movie, could afford to do it. And I still like to do that. So, yes, movie buff. And that's part of it. To answer your second question about how I brought the two together, it's a two-pronged answer to that question as well. One is that I was teaching at a seminary in the Schroeder House that you mentioned earlier, and that position ended rather abruptly and unexpectedly. And so I found myself, in response to that, being somebody in my mid-40s and an academic, not finding any job prospects, watching horror again as a way of coping with what had happened to me. And so it became a coping technique. And that's really when I started to, I think, use films in a way that was more than just entertainment. It was kind of a therapy. And I found that horror actually helped me far more than other genres did. I watch all kinds of films, but horror really seemed to be particularly helpful. And the second prong of it was that after that incident, I ended up teaching for a while at Rutgers University, and I was an adjunct there, so I didn't have a regular teaching schedule, and I taught whenever there were free slots available. So as many as, I think in my 1 year, 11 courses in 1 year, and I would take their slots like this, January term, the summer term, 2 courses a semester if I could. So whatever I could possibly do to try to make ends meet. And during a Jan term course, which was compressed, it was about 3 weeks in length, and the classes were 4 hours long, and they were in the night. So it was like from 6 to 10. And I thought, that's an awful long time to listen to anybody talk. Even I get tired of hearing myself talk after that length of time. And so I thought one thing I could do, and these were Bible courses, so one thing I thought I could do was have students watch clips from movies where the Bible occurred and have that as a discussion point. So how was the Bible used in this movie? How did you see it functioning? It's almost as a character in some cases. So I started asking those questions, and I started to notice that quite a few of the movies I was using were actually horror movies, which surprised me because I knew the Bible was in those movies, but I didn't really I thought it's kind of odd that the Bible shows up so often in horror. And that's really what led me to write the book.
That's so interesting, because I thought you were going to say something like, the greatest story ever told, the Ten Commandments, the ones that people usually think about, but the horror is where you went. Can you tell us a little bit, this is just my follow-up, because I know Robin has a ton of questions, but you said that it was therapeutic for you to watch horror movies in particular. What about them is therapeutic? And I'll say as an aside, my late husband used to love horror movies, and he would always say, I like to get scared sometimes. Is that part of it?
I don't really like to get scared. And that's one of the odd things about it. The therapy for me, I think, comes in the sense that realizing how bad things are in my own situation at times, that they're worse for other people, and that I can be thankful that things aren't so bad for me. So it's I notice this when I'm reading, too. I found that when I had struggles with difficulties in my own personal life, that reading books about, say, the Holocaust actually helped, because I realized things aren't that bad. I mean, they could be much worse. And I think horror does that as well, but it does it in a different sort of way. Of course, you know how movies can be so intense, and so you can get drawn into the story. And I'll find myself still watching movies, horror movies by myself at night, and thinking, I don't know how this one ends. I don't want to watch this. I'm scared, and not being comfortable with that. But when it's over, there is such relief. It's like, it's done. And it really feels like I'm in a better place when I watch it.
It's like coming out on the other side of a haunted house experience.
Exactly. Yeah, that's like very much like it.
We've made it through. Mm-hmm. We've triumphed through that. Well, one of the things that I really liked about your book was you talked about how religion started mixing with horror around, I think you started maybe with the Blob, but how the point of the question is like how the later that it's gotten, the way that horror shows up in movie is a bit more explicit. So like early on, I'm trying to think of a good example. Maybe Carrie is a good example, but in one of the Carrie movies, there was something that happened that the remake did, but the original didn't, because the world wouldn't have been ready for it when the original was released.
Carrie's mother hits her with the Bible.
The Bible, that's it. Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. So just about Bibles in general, you talk about them being, and I kind of liked this, The reason that they are effective in movies, that Bibles are both a tool for salvation and damnation. They act as the ultimate unquestioned authority, and people can use them to abuse, and the Bible is also abused, certain ideas. But the Bible, when it's introduced in a movie, doesn't need to be introduced because it's so much a part of the psyche of our culture. So a director can just get a lot of bang for his buck by introducing the Bible or any kind of religious symbol, right?
Yes. And I think that a lot of times, this is just a speculation on my part, but I think that maybe a lot of times the Bible is a way of showing God in a movie because it's instantly recognizable. Everybody knows what it is, but very few people are literate enough in it to really realize what it says or what the message is. They just think of it as a holy book written by God. And so you can't, I've thought, you know, there are movies that try to show God. It's really hard to do and be believable. It's just something that you can't do. And not in the way that the mind will accept it, but you can show the Bible and that does pretty much the same thing. I think you could also make the case you could do the same for crucifixes or other religious symbols, but the Bible is just, crucifixes almost divide between Catholic and Protestant, whereas we all, as a Christian nation, sort of share the Bible. It may not be exactly the same one. It may not be the King James, may not be the Protestant Bible, but we all know what the Bible is. So there's a mix of Protestant and Catholic films, even one film in the book that is more Jewish in orientation, and they all use the Bible in various ways. So it's something that everybody can use. You don't have to worry about offending any particular religion with it, or you offend everybody with it one way or the other. So it works both ways.
And I love how you point out that it's such a powerful symbol. It doesn't even have to say Holy Bible. It could just look like a Bible, and it conveys the same sort of authority.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of times in movies, it's hard to tell. When I was seeing the movies for this, doing research by watching movies is quite interesting because you sometimes have to pause a frame and zoom in as much as you possibly can to see if you can see any writing on a book. Is it the Bible or not? Because a leather-bound book with gilt-edged pages, that's a Bible in the average person's mind. It may not be, but that's what they think it is. And so I tried to confirm whenever I say that it's actually the Bible in the book, that it is the Bible. But sometimes it's really pretty hard to tell.
I learned a lot about the Bible reading this book. I was raised in an evangelical fundamentalist kind of environment, Southern Baptist in Oklahoma. And I learned some new things. And I want to get to some of those things. I have questions about some of those things. But I also, I know that Deborah really wants to get to some of the fun of the movies. And you've broken your book out in categories. So like popcorn horror movies are just more movies where the Bible or some Christian symbol kind of shows up as a subtle reference. Like maybe somebody's carrying it under their arm and it conveys a message. That's right, right? Like you mentioned in Psycho, just adds a little bit of flavor.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the purpose, especially with a director like Alfred Hitchcock, who was very careful about what was in the scene. You could have people walking out of a church is a very brief shot. You could have people walking out of church without a Bible. But when you put the Bible in, it suddenly gives a respectability to the characters that they might not otherwise have. And interestingly to me, and one of the reasons I included Psycho in the book, is that the remake throws the Bible in there all the time. Or not all the time, but quite frequently, more so than the original did. And I found that whenever I watched a movie that had a reboot or a remake, that the way that they treat the Bible is always different. No matter how shot by shot, slavishly reshot the movie might have been, they still change when it comes to the Bible. The directors all have their own ways of handling it, which I thought was really fascinating because it does have subtle messages.
Well, and that's that was what I was trying to get to with my initial clumsy question, because I find that fascinating, even like subtly changing a Bible verse in a movie, that in the first movie it would have been one thing, and in the second movie they've switched it to something else. Essentially, you get to the same ultimate meaning, but it's just a little bit different. I think that's also maybe a Carrie reference. There was a different Bible verse that her mother threw at her in the remake, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a couple of places where she does that. Yeah, she cites the Bible. And I think that going back to your earlier observation, maybe when the original movie came out, it was a little bit too soon to use the Bible too much in horror. And I mean, because people might have been offended by it. I mean, that was, I'm forgetting the exact year, but early 80s, late 70s. Maybe a little bit, I think 1976, if I remember correctly, a little bit too early to use the Bible that way. And later in the remake, which was, you know, just a few years ago, we're ready for it now.
Before we move past Carrie, this is one of my strange questions that I had written down to ask you later. But since we're with Carrie, I'm going to ask you anyway. So Carrie, the theme of menarche, a young woman's first period, and a crazy religious mother, I think is how you put it in your book. That theme of menarche came up in more than one movie. What is it about a young woman's first period that is both connected to religion and horror?
Well, I can imagine it being an experience. Of course, it's not something I experienced myself, but I can imagine it being a frightening experience for a young woman, even if they know it's coming, or especially like in Carrie, where she doesn't know it's coming. It's scary. I mean, you know, blood is a scary thing, and then all of a sudden it's, you know, coming out somewhere you never expected it to. That's a very frightening thing. And I think that also the aspect of the religious aspect is that in the Bible, it seems that there's a lot of concern about that. A lot of concern about blood being impure and defiling. And so there's these burdens that are put on women that simply don't apply to men, saying this is something kind of a taboo and you can't do this, you can't do that. And if you sit on something, somebody can't touch it. And it's like, you know, this is just really beyond the pale in some ways of what we consider normal social behavior. And it's based on religious understandings of biology. And I'm currently working on a project where the same topic comes up, but more broadly about sex and how that also is one of those areas that the Bible just is not sex is not a taboo in the Bible, but they're uncomfortable with it. And the same thing, I think, is true of menarche, is you've got this situation that they didn't understand what was really going on. It just seems kind of scary and out of place. And it fits very well with horror, too, because the fear of the unknown or the unexpected comes right in there.
I want to switch gears again, and I don't remember the order of the chapter, so forgive me for just jumping around like this. But one of the things that really caught my interest was the unholy trinity, Rosemary's Baby, The Omen, and The Exorcist. Talk to us about why you call it the unholy trinity and what ties them together.
Yeah, this could be based on my experience more than anything else. So this is, I just remember, I grew up in I was born in the early 60s. So I was just reaching kind of my teenage years in the early 70s. And these movies started to come out then. And I'll confess, I did not see any of them when they came out. I would have been terrified. I only saw them as an adult. I was probably in my 40s before I saw any of them for the first time, because they just scared me. And they're based on, it starts with The Exorcist. And I think The Exorcist is a landmark movie, no matter how we look at it, because it changed horror. It changed American movies. It changed it as going into nightmares with the Bible. It changed the way we look at demons. I mean, it changed so many things. And it's still one of my very favorite movies. I think it's just, I've read where people take their kids to the movie and they laugh at it because the effects are old and it just doesn't, nobody's afraid of that sort of thing anymore. But to me, it is almost the perfect horror movie. It just is, and it tied religion in a way that other movies really had trouble doing. Now, the way it was paid for that by Rosemary's Baby. And Rosemary's Baby, of course, came out in 68, so it was a little bit before The Exorcist. I look in vain to find any movie that treats religious themes seriously, horror that treats religious themes seriously and is able to pull it off before Rosemary's Baby. I just don't see it. It's just not there. And so Rosemary's Baby showed that you could take a biblical theme and take it seriously and treat it in horror in a way that scared people. I mean, here's the devil in New York City of all places. I mean, you wouldn't expect that. And it is a very frightening thing. And people were talking about it when I was growing up. As a fundamentalist at the time, I used to get those Jack Chick tracts that you sometimes find people handing out on street corners. And they warned against watching movies like Rosemary's Baby because it was making light of the fact that this Antichrist is really real. And so then you get the, that is the starting point. Then The Exorcist kind of just blows everything out of the water. And then 3 years later, you get The Omen, which of course is based on the same theme as Rosemary's Baby. It's almost like, you know, the baby's grown up and has become the Antichrist. It's not exactly, that's not exactly what happens. But obviously that also brought in this religious element again in a way that really frightened people. And so these three movies occurring in that time period of 5 or 6 years there just changed the way that people looked at horror, because they realized that not only was religion in horror, it could be the basis of the horror. In all three movies, there's no horror there without the religion. It's simply the religion drives the movies. And so that really is what caught me about being an unholy trinity. And I thought of it simply because, as a child growing up, those were the three movies that I was too afraid to watch. I watched a lot of horror, but those ones I would not see. And I eventually got to the point where I got over it and really enjoy all three of them now. But that was what was going on with the Holy Trinity, just that they had changed things. And other movies would take up religious themes and sort of run with them, but these three just had such a social impact, a cinematic social impact, that I just can't find anything else that equals them.
So did the cultural and kind of social revolution things of the day contribute to those films hitting the scene?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm convinced of that. A lot of people don't realize that if you look at the best-selling book from the 1970s, the entire decade, the best-selling book is The Late Great Planet Earth by Hal Lindsey, which is predicting the end of the world based on his biblical chronology and his gymnastics that he goes through to make it work. And that is what was happening. I mean, people were concerned that the world was coming to an end. And so something like Rosemary's Baby suddenly becomes believable. So we've got, the end of the world presaged by Satan raping a woman and, her bearing his son. Or The Exorcist, which, really comes from a different direction, but it has the same kind of concerns. If demons can do this to people, then, what hope have we? And The Omen, of course, is quite explicit about it, because this is based on that the reconstructed figure of the Antichrist. And but people were so tuned to that because of the 70s. And I remember the 70s as, a young person might, but fuel shortages, the Vietnam War was still going on in the early days. There were a lot of talks about ecology and the environmental degradation. People were afraid. And I think these movies kind of picked up on that and did it with a religious aspect that made sense to people.
And amplified both. The religion part of it amplified the movie part. The movie amplified the religion part, right? Fear feeding fear in that case a little bit.
Yeah,
oh,
exactly.
I heard about this so much growing up. The end times, the Antichrist. I still hear about it, frankly, from my church community, my family, still very much there. So I'm still waiting for the Antichrist to come on the scene, It's like some of the...
Well, Robin, you had mentioned about the Antichrist, where that came into the collective consciousness.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that for a minute.
Steve.
You said you were surprised it was not biblical.
This is one of the things that I was so surprised to learn reading your book, that the Antichrist is a post-biblical construction. And that it took hold amidst kind of Cold War fear. I can't believe that. I mean, it's so ingrained in what I learned growing up. It never occurred to me that it's not buried deep right there.
Yeah, the same is true of me. This was a revelation for me as I was writing the book and as I was doing the research, because I had always assumed that the Antichrist, because there are references to an Antichrist in the Bible, but there are no references to a character that we call the Antichrist. Same way as there are no real references to the character we call the devil. These are post-biblical constructions. And they, when you grow up in a religious tradition, an evangelical fundamentalist tradition, you're taught that these are biblical and that they are in the Bible. And in a sense, that's true because it mentions Antichrist, it mentions the devil. But these characters are not biblical. They develop over time. And it's much later that people look back and say, ah, this is what's going on there. They read it back into the text. So it was one of the, I don't think I would have noticed this if I hadn't been working on this book. That's what, one of the takeaways that I had from it too.
Yeah, I was trying to find I'd written a note on that. I was so shocked by learning that alongside the fact that the rapture isn't a biblical idea. This is also something that you unpack in your book. And I mean, it's like if my head could explode, it would have exploded reading that whole section. And that whole section is in the section of the book on the diabolical world, I think, where you talk about Satan and the devil and demons and even the distinctions between all of those. But I was so surprised. And the other thing that I was so gratified to learn, this is one of the questions that I've always wondered, never could get a good answer in my church, got a somewhat okay answer, you know, post deconstruction. It's like the problem of good and evil, right? And I didn't know, I mean, the modern concept of hell, I understood post deconstruction sort of grew out of Dante's Inferno. But you took it back to Zoroastrianism, which was when I think you said sort of that dualism of good and evil came about. And Zoroastrianism is ancient and kind of grounded in the Iranian neck of the woods, Iranian religion. And I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was just, it's the model of heaven and hell, right?
In a way, although heaven and hell are devised from those ideas. I wouldn't say that the Zoroastrians, and we don't know a whole lot about ancient Zoroastrianism because of lack of written texts and such, but the scholars who have studied it in depth have determined that there was a kind of reward or punishment after death. They involved climbing a high mountain where it's cool and kind of paradise, the gods live on the mountains and that sort of thing, or going into an underworld where it will be purified by fire, because Zoroastrianism believes that fire is a divine element. So it's not hell as we understand it, but that is the origin of those ideas that eventually become heaven and hell. And it's much, much later, post-biblical even. I think heaven's a bit earlier than hell. So you can see, I think, a little more clearly you can see heaven in the Bible than you can see hell. But hell is definitely a post-biblical idea as well. It's got some roots in the Bible. It's got some roots much earlier than the Bible, but it doesn't become something, a thing or a ding, as I call it in the book, until later.
I like the ding. Also, another ding that you talked about was just our ideas of the end world, end of the world. And that really is just an idea that's been crystallized in the last couple of hundred years, I think is what I remember reading. Which also, growing up in a fundamentalist evangelical church, just, you know, we believe that that's always been the case forever and ever. Amen. But wait, no.
That's one of my favorite things about the book, is it challenged assumptions. It made me challenge assumptions that I held too. And it was kind of a revelation to write the book. And I'm glad that other people have noticed it. So thank you.
Oh my gosh, it's been wonderful.
So I'm coming at this from a completely different place than either of you, because I was raised Jewish. So the New Testament, the Christian Bible, is for me literature. That's how I know it. But I'm hearing, and maybe I'm wrong, but is there a correlation between heaven in the Bible, Christ in the Bible, and hell after as a construct, and the Antichrist after as a construct?
Yeah, I think they're all related, because as you know, in Judaism, there is no hell. There's a Sheol, a place where you go when you die. It's not that you want to go there. It's dreary and dark and, you know, it's not a fun place, but it's not punishment. And everybody goes there. So there's no concept of hell there, nor is there a concept of heaven. You try to live a good life, and that's what your aim is. Whereas in Christianity, it becomes much more focused on what happens after you die. So your life can be miserable, and you still win if you get to heaven when you're done, which is a very unusual way of thinking about things. And I think post-biblical period is when these things start to coalesce into theologies that can be systematized. You don't get that in the Bible. You don't get it in the Hebrew Bible. You don't get it in the New Testament. There's no systematic theology there. It comes much later. And it's as people are struggling with some of these contradictory messages they find in the Bible and contradictory scenes and ideas, I think they're trying to make sense of it. And so you start to get a solidified view of what is heaven, what is hell, what is the devil. These things come much later. And watching horror is that sometimes you tend to think of the Bible as a good thing. It represents God. It's there to save people, you know, it drives away evil and all of that. But increasingly in horror, I'm noticing that the Bible is sometimes used for insidious purposes, and it can be the origin of the abuse. And Red State was probably the most striking example of that. That is a difficult movie to watch. It's very hard to watch even now, even when I wrote about it for the book. But there are other instances, too, where the Bible becomes an abusive implement. It happens in Carrie. It happens in other places as well. And that, to me, is, again, a sign that we've come beyond the point where the Bible is so sacred you can't touch it as a society. We can now start to question, is it necessarily good? And so those kinds of questions, I think, are fairly recent because there was, I think, culturally, we weren't able to accept it earlier. And I think even today, people would find it very profane. Some of the things I suggest that are going on in those movies it'd be inappropriate. I'm sure of that. I'm sure that some people in my own family would also feel that way. But it seems that we've gotten to the point where our society says, you know, maybe there's something here that we should be looking at. Is this necessarily a good thing?
And this isn't exactly on point, but it's related. I love it when you said in the earlier horror movies, you never saw a Bible thrown on the ground or dropped on the ground. And in later horror movies, you do. And it always, you know, pretends somebody's going to die. It's like, Bible on the ground, you're dead.
Yeah, it's almost a formula. When the Bible hits the ground, something bad is about to happen.
Yeah, something bad.
It always does, yeah.
Something wicked this way comes. Mm-hmm.
I was going to ask about, and this is one of Robin's notes, about 666.
Oh, yeah.
And Mark of the Beast. Mark of the Beast. And Revelations. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think that this really got introduced by The Omen. Again, I think that was maybe many people's first exposure to it, other than evangelicals who grew up knowing about that. And so they found out that this is a sacred number, not a sacred number, a very, the opposite of that, a very profane number. And so it becomes a symbol that you can use anytime to refer to evil. And it's interesting in the movies because it sometimes gets put in ways that you don't expect. That horrible movie, that Lost Souls, is not a good movie. I still kind of think when I watch it, when I think about watching it, which I don't do often, that it just doesn't hold together in so many different ways. But they have to throw the 666 in there. And it's almost like it's a throwaway thing. You can put it in there and it makes people say, ah, this is evil. I mean, so much so that, you know, you can see, you buy t-shirts today that say 333, I'm only half bad. I mean, I've seen that. And it's become a cultural trope that anything with 666, one of my neighbor's license plates has 666 on it, not only 666, but you see it and say, ooh, is there something going on there?
Mm-hmm.
You know, yep. It's just, it's become an interesting sort of way of measuring whether something is good or bad. And again, it's not something that's particularly prominent in the Bible. It gets mentioned once. And scholars are divided on whether or not it's actually 616 or 666, depending on how you add it up or how the numbers come out. And according to different manuscript traditions, it's not always the same. And so we've got this thing that has become a cultural meme in its own right and has taken on a life of its own, again, associated with the Antichrist, the end of the world. So all those things, the bad, the evil, gets sucked into that one cultural nugget that keeps on coming up.
That is still pretty prominent in our neck of the woods. I was just talking with somebody on our health sciences center. Deborah and I both work at a university that's connected to a health sciences center. And we're trying to vaccinate people, right? And I was joking with this person. I said, well, you know, because we have people who won't accept it because for lots of reasons. But I said, well, pretty soon you'll probably start hearing that there are people who don't want to take it because they think it's a way that the Antichrist is going to get the mark of the beast inside the body, right? And she goes, oh, no, we've already had those calls. So, I mean, it's like, yeah, I didn't think it would take long for that to hit around here because we still take the number of the beast pretty seriously. I mean, people are believers. And
yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that they really are, and it's still true. I mean, a lot of people are still very concerned about it. I know people personally who are concerned that the Antichrist is going to come or is already here. As a matter of fact, if you watch on the DVD that I have, The Omen, if you watch the extras, the writer, David Seltzer, who did the screenplay and the novelization both, is interviewed in the extras, and he said, what's really frightening to me is knowing that he is alive here on the earth right now. And I mean, he's completely serious about it. And again, that's all pretty much in the wake of Hal Lindsey and his reconstruction or his construction of what the end of the world would look like.
Mm-hmm. Well, my people are still right there. I mean, you know, my family and my community still definitely believe we're in the end times.
Shawshank Redemption.
Oh, yes.
Watching that movie, and it's been a while since I've watched it, I admit, but I don't remember anything specifically biblical or horrific in the horror movie sense. Why did you include this movie?
A couple of different reasons. One is this is a Stephen King movie. And to my mind, I know Stephen King writes in other genres. I understand that. But to me, Stephen King is horror, no matter how you approach it. And the other is that I think that horror sometimes is equated very simply with one type of movie or one set of types of movies, which have certain things in common. I tend to define horror as something that really frightens you. And this is appropriate for incarcerated Christians podcast here. But incarceration, to me, physical incarceration, is one of the scariest things possible. And so I see a movie like that, and it just frightens the living daylights out of me. It took a lot of cajoling for me to watch it. And as a matter of fact, the only reason I did watch it ultimately was that somebody said, you need to see this because there's a really interesting Bible scene in it. I thought, okay, I need to see it. And since I forced myself to watch it and kind of confront those sorts of fears, I thought it's worth putting in the book. Because I think to me it is horror, along with The Green Mile, another Stephen King book, and I've not seen that movie. I just can't bring myself to do it. It's one of those places that it really is very personally frightening. And I think that for horror, it really depends on what frightens somebody. And sometimes it's unexpected.
Is that, you know, feeling frightened in advance of even watching it, is that tied in? Is it wired into your makeup just because of your upbringing? It is for me. That's why I ask. Like The Green Mile, the guy's a sin eater. I don't know that I want to watch a sin eater. You know, it's hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it is. And I think that no matter how hard, if you grew up like you and I did, Rob, it's very hard to get beyond that. And I tell people who know me now as in my current state that I'm still afraid of hell. I mean, I don't believe that there's a physical hell or even a spiritual hell, but I'm still scared of it. Again, that's one of the reasons I find movies so therapeutic, is that they can actually help you try to work through some of these things.
Move through that. And the Shawshank reference, the one thing I love about it is it's the one movie in your book where you said there's actually redemption. The Bible both saves and condemns in one fell swoop, and the good guy wins out.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's one reason that people would probably say it's not horror. It ends too nicely.
But, yeah. I'm with you about that imprisonment. That's scary stuff. I definitely want to ask about your chapter on the deceptive scripture, because I love it when you say, if it just sounds biblical, people buy it. And we have all of these idioms in our society, you know, that people just buy. They say it's in the Bible. And so, I mean, we're not literate enough to go, no, it's not. And it works just because somebody attributes it to the Bible. Would you speak to a couple of the characters that you chose to highlight that?
Yeah, well, the one that, again, some people question my choice of putting Pulp Fiction in the book because it's not really technically horror. But I think that's probably one of the best examples, because you've got this, the Jules character constantly citing Ezekiel, I think it's 25:17, if I remember correctly. And it's a made up verse. It's not real. But it sounds biblical. And so people say, yes, I can believe that that's biblical. And, you know, Quentin Tarantino was trying to get something that sounded Wrath of God-ish to come out of his mouth, which it does. It sounds very much like that. And when I first saw the movie, I thought, I wouldn't have expected that of Ezekiel. I'd have expected that maybe of Isaiah, perhaps, in one of his bad moods, you know. But it's not Ezekiel. And so I went and checked it, of course, and it wasn't. And so I came to realize that, and I also knew this growing up, because kids would come to me. I read the Bible as a kid. And I had other kids at school coming up to me and saying, the Bible says this. And I'd say, no, it doesn't. You know, it, they simply didn't know. Somebody had told them, and they believed it. So it's very easy to do in movies.
Yeah, for sure. And then it gets, and what you're, one of the major points that you make, which I love, is that if we're learning about the Bible through pop culture, and in this particular case, this book is, we're learning about it through the mix of religion and horror, that's what people come to understand about it. And then that's what they then carry into their everyday, you know, lives. It sort of, it gets incorporated into their belief system. But even within communities that study the Bible, like I was part of a community that studied the Bible. My goodness, we used to get stars for, you know, every verse that we've memorized. You know, it's like the gold stars. You remember those?
Yes, I do.
And I still, there are still things that I didn't realize weren't really part of it until I read your book. But also even things like, you know, spare the rod, spoil the child. Well, that's not exactly what the Bible says. They've taken some parts and they've taken it out of context, which is exactly what you talk about in your book. It's powerful. And would you say, so, I mean, I'm trying to think of like big picture here. So the big so what of the book is, what would you say? What is the big so what of the book?
For me, and I realize that as the author, I don't have the final answer here, but for me, I think it was that the Bible is being interpreted by popular culture, and that those of us who've made a career in some way or another as biblical scholars tend to think that we're the ones getting at the truth of it and learning the deep secrets and the meaning behind the text and everything. We're not. It's actually popular culture. That's where people will go to get their answers. That's where they'll see the Bible and they'll say, this is what the Bible says. This is what the Bible is. After Pulp Fiction came out, people were quoting Ezekiel all over the place. And it's like, you're not quoting the Bible, but yes, they were. In their minds, they were. And that was the reality. And so I think that we've got to acknowledge that biblical interpretation is a part of popular culture, and it's not something that specialists, I mean, who reads an academic article on the Bible? Not even ministers do that much anymore. I mean, it's just too, it's too much work, and it's too technical and all of that. So it's become a very much a situation where the Bible is in the public domain, and it has become interpreted by other people who we would not say are biblical scholars. But I tend to think that most directors and writers know pretty well what they're doing.
Steve, do you see a danger in that?
Yeah, I do, because I think that religion can hurt people, and it does. And I think that if you don't have experts who can say, yes, this is or this is not, I see so many biblical authors trying to convince people that the Bible doesn't say this or doesn't say that, but they're doing it in venues that people aren't going to read. And so the narrative becomes the narrative of pop culture. And if somebody wanted to, and I shudder to think this, but if somebody wanted to really damage people by putting the Bible out there in a way that was very hurtful, they could do it. The nearest that I can think of that comes, anything comes to that, is like the Left Behind series of movies.
Oh, yeah.
But they can really cause damage when they do that. But hopefully their motives are actually better than somebody who's really trying to cause damage. I think they really could.
That Left Behind series was so flipping scary to me growing up. Deborah, do you know what? Have you heard of this series?
I have not.
It's basically in times when, you know, all the good people go up, select people go up, and everybody else is kind of left behind, and we're all fending for ourselves. But it's in a, you know, like in a kind of an apocalyptic world. Is so scary. I mean, the books are so scary, but they're still circulating widely. Yeah. So it's for me, I have a problem with the use of fear to keep people in check because, well, that's what, you know, I my greatest hope is that people can grow beyond that. But fear is so powerful in keeping people in check. But it's also part of what I love about what you're doing is you're showing how, you know, even though the Bible is used in horror movies to scare us, it's a safe scare because it's just a movie. It's like, I don't know. I really appreciate that about it. And I cannot wait to read the next one, your latest one, the one about demons. Is it demons in movies? Tell us a little bit about this next book.
Yeah. Okay. It's a hybrid in a way. There was a new series coming out, Horror and Scripture, that I was asked to contribute to. And at the time, the way I write books, I actually write several at a time. I've always got more than one going on at one time. Right now I've got four. And so it's just a matter of trying to figure out which one to focus on. And when I got the invitation, I thought, well, I've got a book that I'm writing about demons, just about what demons are, because there wasn't a whole lot that's changed since I started writing the book. Now there are quite a few books about that, but there weren't at the time. So I started writing a book about demons, and I had started writing a book about sequels, because one of the things in Holy Horror that I decidedly did not do was go into sequels, because sequels change the original story, and then you have to go back and explain things. And I thought, well, there are so many sequels to so many of these movies that deal with the same kinds of topics. But I thought, well, if I narrow that down to demons, then I can actually do the sequels with demons and put that together with the demons material. And then what the book is, the first half is kind of an introduction to demons from the ancient world up until early modern period. And then the second half is how that gets played out in the movies, giving special emphasis to The Exorcist, because The Exorcist really kind of changed the way demons were portrayed in movies forever. And so starting with The Exorcist, it kind of makes a case for the various movies that have had sequences where the demons appear more than once through paranormal events, paranormal activity, that series. The demons are active throughout the whole thing. It really is. So what it does is it traces the demons through these various movies and sees how they portray demons.
And going back to The Exorcist, is that the one movie, like if somebody wasn't really that attuned to the mix of religion and horror in a movie, and I do love the fact that you said people who were raised, you know, sort of in our background, we kind of pick up on those things faster in movies because we've been attuned to it, trained for it. But is that the one movie that you would have people start with if they really wanted to go in and sort of look at symbols and the Bible? Would it be The Exorcist?
I think so. Yeah, I think that it just speaks so much to the fears that we have, as well as the this whole question of good and evil that you raised earlier. It speaks to the Bible, the way the Bible is perceived. It plays into so many of these things. And as I said earlier, I think it's maybe the perfect horror movie. So it really is a very good place to start. The first time I saw it is in the broad daylight in the middle of the afternoon, and I could spend some time doing something else before going to bed. But now it still scares me sometimes. I mean, sometimes it depends on how I feel, but there are times when I just can't watch it. It's just too scary. So yeah, I tend to think that it really kind of encapsulates a lot of what I was doing in that book. And it also is a good segue into the next book as
into
well.
Into the next one. I look forward to reading your next one.
Oh, thank you.
And you are such a good writer. I mean, it's fun to read, but you pack in some really great stuff. I mean, it's beautifully done. I loved it.
Well, thank you. That's
very accessible.
Very kind of you to say.
Well, I don't know about you two, but tomorrow during daylight, I'm probably going to rewatch The Exorcist.
I was just thinking that. It's been a while since I've seen it, but I'm such a scaredy cat.
We can be on the phone together as we watch it during daylight.
We'll share in the scare. We'll share in the scare.
We'll share in the scare. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, Steve Wiggins, we have so enjoyed talking with you this afternoon and wish that we had more time to do it. But thank you so much for being here. And listeners, please go check out Dr. Wiggins's website. That's steveawiggins.com, and also his books on Amazon.
And that website is amazing. And his blogs are super cool. I listen to some of your podcasts that are on there that are linked in through there. It's a great website. And you're kind of a quirky guy. And it is so lovely to like read your pages on your website because your personality shines through. I loved it. So yes, please go check out his website.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and I enjoyed the conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Thank you for listening to the Incarcerated Christian Podcast. We invite you to rate and review our show. And remember, you can find this interview and others on our website, theincarceratedchristian.com, or anywhere you access podcasts. Don't forget to connect with us on Instagram and TikTok at The Incarcerated Christian, and on Twitter at @TICC_podcast_. You can find more information about us and our show on our website. Again, that's theincarceratedchristian.com. Until next time, go forth in love and light.